Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis, and this is a different type of show. For those of you listening, you know that I don't do a chat room because there are people out there that write things that I don't want to hear. So I have it on my Facebook wall, and if anybody has questions, they can ask them on my Facebook wall, and I will have them answered. We're going to talk about a lot of serious issues that are in the news. Last month, I was very upset listening to the news, and I found out that there was no metal detectors in the school that I went to in the South Bronx on Mohegan Avenue, 181st Street on Mohegan Avenue, Pier 67. Pier 67 is called the Marine Wildlife School, something like that, and the child was killed because someone went into the school with a gun, and it bothered me. When the mayor got on television and said, you know, is this what we're coming to? Do we really need metal detectors? At which point, I was fuming. So today we have former FBI agent Michael Tabman, and we're going to talk about that. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Fran. How are you doing today?
I'm doing okay. what do you think about that? I mean, kids today, I know before I moved from the Bronx, I would get coffee and stuff, and while my mother died, we went into the bodega. And the high school kids that went to school near me, had to give up their cell phones and their iPads, and they had to leave them there. They had to pay $1 to keep them there every single day, and they were not allowed any electronics in school. Yet my niece in Florida could text all day, and I think that's wrong. There's got to be a happy medium. But metal detectors, what do you think about that?
Well, you know, going with what you first said, the difference in rules in schools, it looks at a lot of laws and regulations are decided by the community and community values. You know, that's why we have these arguments like with gun control. You know, there are communities where guns are just such a way of life that the thought of, you know, doing any kind of restriction on them, you know, seems abhorrent, where people like myself who grew up in Queens, where nobody owned a gun, we, you know, have a different perspective. So you go to a school, for example, a friend of mine just recently told me she went back to where our school was in Queens, our high school. She wanted to show her son just the school where she went, and they wouldn't let her in. There's lines backed up with metal detectors, and, you know, she lives in a small town. Now she's like, well, how did this happen? Well, you know, what's going on here? So there may be many communities where they just don't find that acceptable. We, you know, we do have to accept that security is imperfect and that we just can't make ourselves such a secure society that we can't function. And the question many people will have, or many communities will have, is do we want our schools to be more like a prison, you know, where kids are metal detected, searched, you know, and so regimented, or do we want it to be an environment where they, you know, maybe they don't look forward to going to school, but at least it's not an unpleasant day, and, you know, they're not going to be so deterred by it. So I think that's a question that will always be answered by the community. And certain places will put in metal detectors. I know happens in some places in New York City, and so the more maybe suburban areas, even though the risk is just as great or just as little no matter where you are. Areas like New York are more likely just by the sheer numbers, you know, that it may happen. But some communities just don't want it, and that's their call.
I know. They put them in the day after. They put the metal detectors in where they were supposed
to. They do. They do. But, you know, I don't know how to respond to that because, again, you know, look at the subway system, you know, in New York, this is not the first time we had something like this in a subway system. The question comes, you know, do we start implementing security there? Airports, you know, we don't have the same, I mean, on the national scope, you have, you know, a lot of people. But think of the millions of people, literally millions, not just hundreds, not just thousands, the millions of commuters going through New York City every day. Is it reasonable to start implementing those, which we may, but what will happen to commerce, you know, within the city of New York if we start doing that? So everything has to be weighed against risk-reward. We're not going to stop these attacks from happening, just like we're not going to stop murder from happening or any other crimes from happening continually. We do have laws, or they do deter. We do have policemen and policewomen out there who do deter and do stop things from happening, but we can't stop everything from happening.
That's the sad part. That's what's really scary. Because, you know, you walk in the street, and I watch people walk in Manhattan. I watch people walk up here where I am, and they don't watch where they're going. They're sitting with their cell phones. And, I mean, the other day I'm walking, and I said to this man, could you move out of the way so I can walk? And he almost bumped into me because he was so engrossed in what he was doing that he didn't even watch where he was going. And then you notice that people crossing the street are still texting, and they're not watching the light. Of course. I mean, you can walk in Manhattan and you can hear a feather drop because nobody's talking. They're just ignoring the public. So what should people do? I mean, they need to be more aware of their surroundings. I walk with my cell phone in my pocketbook. Unless it rings and there's somebody that I really want to speak to, I'm not going to talk to them while I'm walking in the street because I think that's rude to the person that you're walking with.
Well, you know, it's rude. It's dangerous, especially, I tell people, if you're going to go and put earpiece in, at least leave one of the earpieces out. You can hear with one ear and at least hear what's going on around you. So if something happens, at least you're alerted to the fact. But we're looking from two perspectives. We're looking, one, distracted pedestrians. We've talked about that before, walking out into traffic. Mm-hmm. Or, even in a place like New York where people are kind of stressed, you bump into each other and you'll have, street rage, as opposed to road rage. Some people, because everyone's in a hustle, everyone's in, maybe in a bad mood. So you have to, for your own personal safety, you have to know if someone's creeping up on you. You should be aware of your surroundings. But then what do we always say about the terrorist threat? We say, see something, say something. And the eyes and ears of the public really are, some of the best tools law enforcement has. As hackneyed as that sounds, it really is, because, we don't have so many police officers watching so many things. But if you're out there and you see, a man with a, putting a strange package in a garbage bin or something, or planting it behind something, that's, it's pretty suspicious. That's what you want to report to law enforcement. But as you said, if you're walking around with your nose in the phone, it's going to be trouble. And you're not going to see the things we need you to see and report on.
I guess growing up in the Bronx, I learned that you have to keep your eyes and ears open. Walking by my street, so I saw going back and forth to school, and I lived in a bad neighborhood. And I was little, and I'm saying, okay, I'm going to have to, really be careful. And kids didn't walk around with cell phones or anything because my mother wouldn't let me have one. And we didn't walk around with a whole lot of money. So
cell phones, I don't think we had them back then, Fran.
I don't know what.
I don't think our mothers had a choice with us.
All I know is that I was lucky if I had my own phone in my room. I was lucky, whatever.
My wife and I talk about those days, yeah. The Sunday night phone calls to kids. That's what it was. Right. That's all you could afford back then.
Yeah, I know. My parents didn't think it was necessary to us to sit on the phone. And my grandmother owned the television, so that took care of that. So that's probably why I was a straight-A student. Because what else was I going to do but read books and, report on them? What can I say? So
there you go.
One of the things that bothers me in the schools and bothers me in general is all these, even adults that we hear on the news, that are bullying people. And it bothers me. There was a little boy that's on Twitter, Keaton, and his mother put a video on Twitter about what's happening to him. Now, it bothers me. The schools, most schools, not all, have a no tolerance for violence and deal with bullying, yet it still happens. So why aren't school officials taking more of a harder line? We have these adults that are accused of doing whatever they're else. That's a form of bullying, too.
It is. Friend, I would think after my 27 years in law enforcement, and 10 years since I retired, and I speak about it with the media, that somehow it's inured me against, the stress and almost depression I feel from these stories, but it hasn't. When it comes to bullying, that's one of the things I've always had an issue of. And actually, I was bullied as a kid. It's nothing like what goes on now. It was just some of the, schoolyard stuff, and it was over, quickly. It wasn't what happens now. And it breaks your heart to see this kid, he says, no fault of his own. And, there's a story I tell. I mentioned in my first book, so I wrote the story. My son was about 10, 11 years old. We were at one of the kids' birthday parties. I don't even know if it was ours, at a bowling thing. And I just kind of noticed the boys seemed to be sort of teasing or something, one kid, not pushing him around, but I saw something was wrong, and looking at him, I sensed, maybe Asperger's or something, something about the appearance. And I called my son over, so what's going on there? He said, they're kind of just teasing him because he's a little strange. I said, I don't want you doing that. He said, I'm not that, but, the other kids are. I said, well, go over there and stop it. And he said, why is that up to me? I said, because if you don't, no one else will. And you got a dad who's an FBI agent, you got a mom who's a special ed teacher, that's what we do. And, and he did. And then another time, one of my kids was in my house in junior high school, or middle school, they call it, where I am. And his friend, who was a minority, got suspended because he got into a fist fight with somebody. And my son, who was there, confirmed that, the kid his friends, the other kids started, you know, started with racial slurs, and they got into a fight. So the school just went and suspended both of them. Zero tolerance. That is not zero tolerance. That is laziness and not wanting to try to figure out, you know, who the antagonist was and mm-hmm. punish them. And the concept of, you know, walk away. You know, that's easy for us to say as adults, you know, if you're in a road rage, just drive away. But when you're a kid, especially a young boy, and I've been in that situation, that's just not the, you know, the thing you're going to do. It's not your visceral reaction. Your reaction is to defend yourself and, you know, not, you know, let it keep happening. And, you know, the schools just aren't willing to take the time. And I've lived in many different school districts, and I've raised my kids through several, and I see this continuously, is they come up with this bogus answer, you know, zero tolerance, everyone's in trouble, because they don't want to, you know, go after the antagonist, do the work it takes. And I even asked my son, I said, well, why were you standing there while your friend, you know, was in a fight? I said, Dad, if I jumped in, I'd get suspended too. And my answer was, you get suspended, I will take care of that. Mm-hmm. I don't ever want to hear, you know, you didn't jump in there and protect your friend. You know, it's just how life is. And, you know, maybe, you know, you and I grew up in New York City. Maybe our attitude's a little different, you know, than somewhere else. But, you know, it can't be tolerated. And I'm not talking about vigilantism. I'm not talking about going overboard. But you can't ask a young boy to just cower away and run to a teacher and think that's going to maintain any kind of self-esteem for him. And expect that to solve the problem. They'll just become more of a target. The school has got to become more aggressive. They've got to put more eyes and ears out in the hallways, and they got to listen to kids mm-hmm. and open up, you know, communication paths where kids can report it, and then they have to be able to take action and put a little effort into finding the antagonist and putting the penalty on him, not on the one who's just trying to protect himself.
I think the hardest job I ever had was the dean, because I had to deal with kids that bullied other kids. But they wouldn't dare bully me. And I can't tell you how many fights that started, not in the school. Actually, when I walked around, nobody did anything wrong because they knew little person over here wasn't going to tolerate it. And I was even taught how to break up fights. And one of the teachers was a karate expert. So she taught me some moves that I haven't forgotten, sort of. But, you know, yeah, we had a peer mediation program. And we talked about, you know, what you do, and they had we discussed it. But seriously, I mean, my aunt told me when I was younger to fight back. And, you know, my mother used to say to me, don't fight, I'll take care of it. And somebody hit me once, and my aunt, you didn't miss her, my aunt, she's a big person, she said, if you don't hit him back, I'm going to hit you. I said, but hitting is wrong. She says, you have to let him know that he can't put you down. So I smashed him. And, I didn't feel better. But I said, is that the way that people want to be? I don't want to be that kind of person. So I guess as an educator, you had to be tough, but I used my mouth. And I guess now I still use my mouth because it seems to work. I have nobody messes with this girl because you can't. But school violence increases with the amount of guns in school. I mean, how many schools have gone into recently, and police presence, and it's scary. I mean, How do you teach kids not, I mean, the week after this murder in the school across the street from where I used to live, that I don't live there anymore, a kid came in with an unloaded gun and they caught him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is this the way that parents are teaching kids to defend themselves? Because if it is, we're in big trouble everywhere.
Right. I have to back up a bit there, because again, schools, you know what I'm saying there, you know, when we used to get into fights as kids, you know, like I said, it was over. Thought of someone returning with a gun, even a knife or something else. We just didn't mm-hmm. think about it. You know, it was just so the schoolyard
yeah.
fight, one kid says uncle, it's over, you shake hands the next day, or even the same day and you go and you finish the game of basketball, whatever it was. It was a different world, and we have to recognize that. So, you know, again, we don't want kids to escalate violence. And I feel I may have, kind of sound like I was promoting that. I wasn't. I was just trying to make a point of not punishing the kid, you know, who just tries to defend himself, you know, and taking the time to, you know, figure out who the antagonist is and make sure they are punished. But, you know, I have friends who have, you know, maybe still young kids in school, and they also fear that, you know, if I tell my kid to fight back, never mind, you know, getting in trouble, you know, we don't want someone else returning
yeah.
with a weapon. You know, so that is a consideration that we have these days. It's a different world. And I think schools need to discipline. I think schools need to teach, you know, ethics within the academic environment.
Mm-hmm.
But school cannot be a substitute for parents. You know, we can't expect that. I don't put that onus on them. You know, it's still up to us to teach our kids the right way, and it's going to be half nurture, half nature. But the school should be a reinforcement for what is ethical behavior and what is right thing, and just intolerant of the rules that when they're broken, because you have to have, you know, nobody lives in a vacuum. We can't make our own rules. We have to live by societal rules all the time. But in terms of the violence and the aggression that you asked about, I don't know if it's so much coming from parents per se. It's just coming from our environment and our society mm-hmm. as it is right now. You know, we promote the tough guy thing in media. You know, we reward in politics tough talk. Though I know all about tough talk. You know, and locker room talk, all that stuff. Been there. Grew up in New York, law enforcement my whole life. I get it. But it's just empty words. But we reward that. We reward bullying. We reward those who, you know, with a big mouth down and using their power. We reward in the media. We reward in politics, and we are reinforcing. You know, that attitude, you know, hey, man, just, you know, you don't have to do it, can't get back, you know, just do some violent action and settle the score. I think that is a message now. I think people think it's sort of rewarded, you know, in terms of the way people mm-hmm. view you, and that is a message we have to get away from, because I think that's what's driving the violence.
I agree with you, and sometimes I say, oh, yeah, I won the fight. Not really. You didn't win anything. I mean, that's what
yeah,
I wrote.
You win the battle, we all lose the war.
That's right. Right after 9/11, we had a student from Pakistan that came to my school, and he was coming out with his class, and he ran back in, and he said, Mrs. Lewis, they're going to beat me up because of where I come from. I said, I don't think so, and I'm little. And I walked out, I go, you want to find out what happens if you go through me? And they just disappeared. And I said to him, mm-hmm. I'm going to talk to them tomorrow. I said, because this is wrong. It doesn't matter that you came from a foreign country. It doesn't mean that you're responsible for what happened to all those other people. And he learned the ways very quickly. I said, I didn't teach you how to behave yourself like that and then become a bully yourself. No. But there are different types of bullying. And this little boy on Facebook and on Twitter, cyberbullying is just as dangerous. Why don't these kids realize that what somebody says doesn't matter? And their opinion of you is just a bunch of words. And
that's easy for you and I and adults to do that. And I always get upset when I see adults trying to get kids to see the world through their eyes. You have to, as an adult, look at the world through the kids' eyes. And, you know, we always say that words hurt. And when kids sit around, I mean, it's not just the words, but it's what the words also means that we're not your friend. You have no one to hang out with, no one to confide in. You know, so the words are painful, but it's what goes on with it. You know, if your friends are teasing you, or you may be annoyed, but you get over it, then you go on and you hang out with your friends. But when these aren't your friends, the message is you're different. No one's ever going to like you. You're never going to have any friends. We all need friendship and companionship. We all do that. And, you know, when this is reinforced, this kid is going to be subject to teasing, kids laughing at him and throwing milk on him, you know, as he said, and, you know, physical abuse with the mental abuse, you know, is just as torturous and not more so, but in combination, you know, we can't tell a kid, you know, don't ignore it. You can't ignore it. You know, poor kids shouldn't have to endure that. And, you know, I don't know where the good kids are. We can't just stand up, you know, for him and befriend him and just stand aware of danger. Where are some of the good kids? Why are we teaching a kid, not heroism, but just, my goodness, stand up for what's right? You know, I remember, you and I have talked about this before. I mentioned my book when, I think it was you asked me, you know, was anyone surprised when I became a cop? And I said, no, because I remember one kid telling me once, my friends got into drugs, you know, sometimes being bullied, sometimes shoplifting was his thing. I never did any of this. And one kid says to me, you know, Tabman, we are so sick of you always doing what's right. And I never forgot that statement because I remember thinking, well, is doing what's right wrong? Because I seem to be on the outside looking in all the mm-hmm. time. I remember being on the losing end of fights because I was trying to stand up for somebody, and I'm getting, you know, I'm on the wrong end of an ass whooping. I'm like, well, was that a smart thing to do? And there's got to be kids out there, again, not to put their own lives in danger. I'm not suggesting that. But at least, you know, do the right thing and stand up and befriend somebody or keep the other kids from you know, doing what they, as you said, like sometimes it doesn't take, you know, fisticuffs. You just stand there and say, cut it out. Sometimes that's just enough. Where are those kids?
I you know something? I wonder if their parents tell them to stay out of it. Because it's sad. One of my nephews a while ago was in high school, and he was on the bus, and he wasn't doing anything wrong. And his friend's mother try to get him in trouble because her son was the one that was doing something wrong and he was cutting school, but not my nephew. And my nephew called, texted me, and he says, I'm in trouble, and they're going to do something. They're going to suspend me from the bus. And I didn't do anything. I said, take a picture of what's happening. And I did. And I texted my brother, and I said, it's not his fault. It's this person's fault. I said, and if you don't want – and I dealt with the mother. I dealt with the kid's mother. And I said, Mama, now you're going to deal with the parents. I said, how dare you accuse my nephew of doing something? His other kids came to his defense, but, you know, the bus driver wasn't really watching what was going on. And that's
what
was sad.
The bus, yeah. Yeah, right. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. You have to be open to the fact
all of us need to be open to the fact that it can be our kid. You know, it can be. You know, and if there's credible, accusations against someone's kid, the teacher says, no, this has happened, we've seen several times. You have to consider that maybe your kid, you know, is not perfect, and we have to look at the mm-hmm. fact. And I'm not saying jump on it just because one someone says something or another parent says something that they didn't see. But, you know, again, if we get some indications that our kids are acting out, we have to be willing to accept, hey, maybe it's time for some intervention, you know, on our part.
Well, you know, the kids, you watch television, all these programs, even the video cartoon programs, even the ones with lots of graphics, and they're all violent. And the other night, my husband put something on. I said, don't you ever watch anything that's nice and pleasant? Don't you ever watch anything where people are killing everybody? And it bothers me because I think kids watch this stuff and they see all these graphic things and then the Transformers and all these other movies that are coming out and they're learning violence and they think it's really cool to be not a superhero but be the villain. I mean, I just read a book by Nora Roberts, Dark and Death, where the character, the villain in the book, thinks that she wrote something that villains are the main characters and they should win out. I get the feeling that kids sometimes feel that being the villain should win out.
Yeah, you know, on a couple of my Crimes and Time shows, Thursday nights, 8 p.m. Central, you know, on Facebook, we've talked about, you know, gangs. We've talked about aberrant behavior, violent behavior. I've had on, you know, sociologists, criminologists, some of the profilers from the FBI. And pretty uniformly, they've said, a little bit to my surprise, that they all do believe that the exposure, the constant exposure to violence does have a desensitizing effect on young kids. Because, you know, our argument would be, look, we all grew up with it. You know, I watch Cowboys and Indians, I watch Cops and Robbers, but they said it's not the same it is now. It's not the 24/7 mm-hmm. exposure. It's not the weekly TV show. It's over and over again on your phones, and it does eventually desensitize you. And it doesn't mean every kid, of course, is going to become that way, but those mm-hmm. who are more vulnerable will, where they may not have without all that exposure. And so we have to think about that as well. I don't think we're going to control it. It's not going to stop. You know, there's no way to keep a kid from watching things these days. But what you have to do is keep a close eye on the kid, have a good relationship, good communications. But most importantly, because, you know, I talk about this when people ask me about, you know, the workplace violence, you know, the next shooter. Most importantly is we have to be open to the thought, look for changes in your kid's personality.
Mm-hmm.
Understand what they are, you know, what's going on different, and intervene when the time's coming. And be open to the idea that maybe your child is experiencing a problem that may turn to some aberrant or violent behavior. Very hard to see that in people we love. But that, I think, is the key, is to be alert for that.
Well, as an educator, I agree with you. There were four boys that were twins. You couldn't tell them apart. The best kids on this planet. So respectful, so behaved. And I went into my friend's class to do a model writing lesson. And all of a sudden, I looked at one of them, and I said, wait a minute, something's not right. He's calling out. He's not focused. Something's not right. This child is not a discipline problem. And I called him out on the side, and I said, I don't want to call your parents to tell you that you're in trouble. What's the matter? And it was a problem at home that I told my girlfriend, who took the class. I said, you need to call the parent. You need to get her in. You need to get the father in. We need to straighten this out now because I'm not going to let him go bad. You can tell.
Mm-hmm.
You have a good student that's quiet, and all of a sudden they become a loudmouth, or a loudmouth that gets too quiet. It's just as bad. And you have to really be. And a lot of teachers are so concerned with not doing what they're supposed to do. Not everyone. They don't listen. They don't watch. They just want to get the lesson done. And if a child is bad, I mean, they get suspended. automatically. And that doesn't always
right.
help either. So my question is this. What people more violent now? Are there places for people, do different countries when people come here explain that this is America and we don't, you know, pride ourselves on violence? Or do these people that come to attack us feel, well, what the heck, we're in open season because this is, they're not going to do anything about it. And yet the police got rammed yesterday for what they did. They handled very well. They stopped the guy, which is fantastic. But then they got criticized for talking to a four-year-old and then a high school student without parents. So what's right and what's wrong?
Well, in general law enforcement, you're not supposed to interview or interrogate, you know, the more common
yeah.
term. FBI, we always say we don't interrogate, we interview a minor without giving the parents a chance to be there. They're not sort of, they can't just, you know, we talk about consent. Consent not always just means just, you know, for sexual relations. Consent to almost anything. You can't consent, just the same reason you can't enter
mm-hmm.
a binding contract as a minor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't consent. So a minor cannot consent to be interviewed by the police. You have to agree to that. They can't force you to be interviewed. So as a general, I don't know if it's written in the statute, but I mean, when I was in law enforcement, that was kind of understood. Now, if you're just in the school, you're asking questions. Now, it's one thing, you know, they, you know, you see what happened, blah, blah, blah. But if there's anything where you're having a kid speak where maybe implicating, you know, the parent or themselves, you got to be calling the parents. I'm not familiar with what happened there with that story, but as a general rule, you're not supposed to interview minors without calling their parents first.
Yeah, they had this whole big thing on the news this morning while they were describing this guy, Ala Ula. And his family was upset about what happened, and he felt bad that he did this, but, you know, why did they do this to this one? Why did they do that to that one? Instead of realizing what he did was horrendous. And they were lucky that the police were able to save so many people's lives. Otherwise, it would have been a more of a disaster. And that's what's
yeah,
scary,
you know,
but the Port Authority, that's scary.
Right, now I'm in travel status now, so I heard about the news, and I commented on some local news. But what were the police, and who criticized the police? I wasn't aware of that. What are you referring
to?
The
family. The family of the killer, of the terrorist.
No, well, that's always going to
happen.
They
said he was
ISIS
radicalist, and they said that it was all over the news this morning that they understood that it was wrong what he did, but they're saying that the police were too, you know, handled this, and that the police said that they were going to look into the interviews to make sure that it was done the right way. And it was done, they claimed that they pulled a four-year-old child out in the cold to question her, and then they took a high school student out of school. This happened at 7:23, something like that, yesterday morning at Port Authority. But the main concern would be is, you know, this guy did this, and no one realized it was supposed to be a suicide bomber. I think I have it memorized now. And he failed too bad. But they're claiming that ISIS,
mm-hmm.
but you don't really know, had nothing to do with it. But you don't know. So
we don't know. My
like,
guess would be, go ahead, I'm sorry.
What do you think?
No, my guess was, again, just based on what I heard, you know, from the news coverage and just looking at sort of the profile, I mean, in very broad terms, I think he was just another, you know, disaffected individual, self-radicalized. My guess would be he took no direction from ISIS or anyone else. Maybe someone helped him, you know, if he had played, build his bomb, but obviously it was very rudimentary, very amateurish. It malfunctioned. He probably did it, you know, on the fly. My guess would be he was operating alone and just for some reason, you know, again, disaffected mm-hmm. and sees that this will bring him some attention or some meaning in his life, just like most of the other ones that we've seen.
Yeah, I know. You never know. Just like the one from Tribeca, but they're not sure about that either.
That's just my opinion.
The second one in 6 weeks. And that's what's scary because you know, in the neighborhood I live, which is a good one, I went into the parking lot the other day to get my oatmeal from the bakery, and there's a sign in the front of the parking lot that says, don't leave anything in your car, don't leave your valuables, and make sure you take everything. And I was like, huh? You know, in this type of an area, you don't normally worry about it, but during the holidays, you never know what's going to happen, and that's what's scary.
Oh, I got that where I go to my gym, and I live in a very quiet city with a very, very, very low crime rate. But they still warn you about that. And look, we had terrorist attacks in my little city of Overland Park, racially motivated a few years ago. A young boy was killed and his grandfather for absolutely no reason. And, you know, it was just heartbreaking. And you know, when the media came and they asked me, well, this time, do you feel differently? I'm like, yeah, when it hits close to home, it does feel differently. I, you know, it was at a place where my kids used to go when they were young, and it could, you know, could have been any one of my friends or family. I didn't know the effect of family, but nevertheless, they're neighbors of ours, you know, and they're local people, and it does, it hurts more when it hits close to home. No question about it.
Oh yeah, I know. It's frightening. My nephew called me. I text my nephew every Friday in college just to torture him, to say, you know, what, do your homework, okay? He says, right now, we're in lockdown. I go, what happened? He said there was a bomb threat in his college. And he wasn't panicking. I was not happy. But me was calm. Then his friends, whatever, they went to Panera restaurant, so they got out of the school and out of the way. And they said it happens all the time with these fake bomb threats. And I said, it sounds like a student that didn't get an A from a professor. I think they found out it was one of the kids that did it, somehow, you know, through the emails or whatever. But how do you handle something like that in a college if that happens all the time? This is a good school. This is an excellent school.
Well, you know, do you remember, I think it was last year, that attack in Ohio State? The guy ran his car into some people and came out with a sword, something like that. Do you remember that story? Mm-hmm. Well, my son goes to Ohio State at the time. I was visiting him. And the irony of it, for lack of a better word, is my wife and I are in his apartment waiting to come back. And he was walking home. And I said to him, I said, gee, it's taking him an awful long time to get back. And then I heard sirens going. Ooh, just one after the other. I'm like thinking, well, unlikely I didn't do my son, but, you know, maybe he got, hopefully it's not him, hit by a car or something. Just worry. Then he walks in. I'm like, whew, glad you're back. I heard all these sirens. And then he looks at his phone. So, look. And then there was a report of the incident. You know, that happened. So, you know, again, very, very close to home. You know, once again, I'm just going to say, well, am I glad you're back? If I heard about that first and he wasn't home, I don't know what I would have done. I probably would have just run down there myself, which is not necessarily a smart move. But, you know, as a parent, you know, we don't act rationally. We, you know, we act to protect our children. But, you know, college, like every other place, is the soft targets we talk about. Okay. Like schools, you cannot secure a campus. There's no way to secure an open campus. And really, on Crimes and Times, just this last week on Thursday night, our discussion was, do guns belong on campus? And, you know, I had a former law enforcement officer, very pro for the idea, and a college professor who was very much against the idea. And there was just a very interesting conversation. But, you know, it's a debate. You cannot lock down a campus.
Well, they locked it down. And then, you know, they finally realized that there was nothing there. But he said that it happens all the time, and I said, this is an outstanding school, and obviously they didn't take it lightly, which is good. I said, oh my God, this is horrible. So what about places like Grand Central Market or the Empire State Building or public places? What should people know? Because this is the time of year that everybody comes in to see the tree.
Right.
They're going to have the menorah lighting. You know, they show that on television. That, yeah, I saw that once. That was really exciting to see them light this huge thing by the Plaza Hotel. So what should people realize, and how much police protection can they be? But if they put all the police there and everything, what about the rest of the city? And
right. And just before I said you can't lock down a campus, I didn't mean they shouldn't do a lockdown at this. A lockdown, I meant you can't secure it by keeping people out, you know, and checking everybody that walks on the campus. It's an open area. You know, unless you would build, you know, fences and tight the entire campus with checkpoints in there, you can't secure it, which is just not realistic. That's what I meant by, you know, locking down. But in terms of these open areas, there is no way to secure these. As I keep saying, you could always build a secure perimeter. For example, take the Empire State Building. That's a building, there's limited numbers of ingress and egress to the building. So you could secure the inside of the building by checking people coming. I haven't been in the Empire State Building for God knows how many years. I'm sure they do that now. Now, when I was a kid, you know, we went there, I think, once to see it. But you know, I'm sure they check it now, and you can secure the inside. But no matter how wide you make that perimeter, there's always a spot, the choke point, where the secure meets the insecure or the unsecure. So you have this security around the Empire State Building, not letting people in, but there's a place where people are waiting to get in. And there's always going to be a spot where the people waiting to be checked. And that's always going to be a soft target because you can't, you got to have to stop somewhere. And that's where someone could attack. We don't know if someone's approaching with a weapon. So again, you know, we've asked that about public venues, like an airport. Should we extend it, you know, past beyond the gates and, you know, to where you first come in? Well, if you do that, you're still going to have a non-secured spot where people are driving up waiting to get through that secure spot. You're always going to have that vulnerable choke point. So you just have to come up with a logical security measure that you have to decide what are you trying to protect. And the airports, really the goal was never to protect, and I don't mean that they were negligent, I mean it was not to protect people from, you know, other, you know, bombs on the street. Other people, it was to protect the airplane itself. You know, that was the goal, and that's how it was set up. And irrespective of what happened 9/11, irrespective of what may have, the few things that may have happened, we've done a fairly good job of securing it, you know, since 9/11. We've had, you know, we can see that, even though TSA, we could talk about TSA, that's another issue, and some of the failures they've had, you know, during tests. But that is the goal, to secure the flights. Now, if we want to talk about securing people waiting, that's a whole other conversation to have. So we have to know what is it we're securing and what are the logical steps we take.
It's scary. I mean, I don't fly that much, but when I did, I looked around at the people that were waiting for the flight, and I looked around to see how I felt about them. And sometimes people actually sit, you make friends with everybody that's there. You don't know who they are. And then you say, well, what do? And where do you come from? And they just have a normal conversation, because that's just me. So I get curious. One guy was going on a Harley Davidson thing. I said, oh, really? Could I come too? And, you know, you don't know who's on that flight. And somehow, some way, how do they get something on the flight, even when they go through TSA, supposedly? Is there a way to get something in a metal or a lead container that nobody would see?
Well, we have, if there is a way to do so, I certainly wouldn't discuss it, you know, publicly. So, you know, but I could tell you that there are weaknesses in every security system. There are things that law enforcement and intelligence community are concerned about now, which I don't have from inside sources, just from following the news. You know, you can probably figure out what they are. And there's always going to be developments for every system we have. There's going to be ways to bypass or fault the system or look for ways to fool the system. So no matter what we implement, we have to think about what's the next thing. And you know, we can't. It's just like people, you know, talking about cybercrime, to use an analogy. You know, right now, with all the tools we have, everything we're doing is cybercrime. Right now, there are two brilliant kids in some garage creating the next great thing in the world of cyber, and awful with good purposes. The day after it comes out, there'll be two brilliant minds somewhere thinking of a way to exploit that for bad purposes. You know, we just don't know what's coming next. So we'll implement security X-rays, other ways to detect weapons or explosives. And then there's going to be some terrorist groups somewhere thinking, all right, how can we bypass this? That's always going to happen. It's always going to be a challenge to stay a step ahead. We have to start figuring out what would people be looking at and how can we get ready for that. And that's why you see these new rules come in, implement new rules after something's happened. And that's not the fault of them, but once something happens, we see, oh, we have a vulnerability here. Let's patch it up.
Yeah. You know what's scary is that I was listening to this report yesterday, and on the internet, this guy learned how to make a bomb. And should that be there? I mean, how to make a gun, how to make a weapon, how to kill somebody. I mean, that's all on the, it's all on there. I mean, one day I was doing something for one of my books, and I'm saying I could look on FBI reports on stuff, too. I said I had to be careful what I was looking at. But, yeah, should that be on the internet, how to make a bomb? Because that's how we learned how to do it. That's what they said.
Yeah, and that's been around for a long, long time, those how-tos, you know, on the internet. I remember that from, you know, basically in the mid to late 90s when the internet was becoming more prevalent, you know, in homes. And it's been there. Again, it takes a certain person to do it. Luckily, we don't have, you know, so many people want to do it. But ethically, should it be there? Probably not. Legally, are we going to stop it? No. And, you know, when we put, like, the onus on Facebook and the other social media platforms to police themselves. You know, I think it's important to ask them to police themselves, you know, and they should do that in their own way. But, you know, they're a public forum. But I don't want the government starting to decide what goes online and not. So even if it was, you know, how to build a gun, I'd rather not see that online. You know, as you could tell from my conversation, I'm not crazy about everyone carrying a weapon. So I'd rather that not be there. But I don't want the government trolling public places and you know, censoring things and them deciding, you know, what should be on there. That to me is more dangerous than anything else we're discussing in terms of our society. So I don't like it, and I would like the private platforms, mm-hmm. you know, like Facebook and what else, to police. And I think they make an effort to. I don't hold them responsible for every bad video that gets onto their program, you know, their platform. But I would like them to make an effort to get rid of those things. It's theirs. They can set their own rules. I don't want the government doing it.
Before I forget, this has been a big week. I was on yesterday with D.P. Lyle and A-List,
mm-hmm.
and today I'm on with former FBI agent Michael Tamman. And on Thursday, I'm going to be on with award-winning author Bruce Coffin, Beneath the Depths. And next week, I'm going on the air with Surveillance, which is an interesting book by Reese Hirsch. And then Gerard de Marini has a brand-new series called Joshua's Country, and that's coming up also. And then after the new year, I'm going to start something very calm and helping everybody to start to forgive, understand, and deal with people of everywhere. Although I'm Jewish, Pastor Michael Jones wrote a book called How to Be a Seventh-day Adventist. Now, Michael knows that I don't write anything religious in my reviews, but I wrote what I learned. And I'll tell you something, you can learn a lot by reading his book. So that's going to be my first show for this girl after the holiday. And if you want to know what to read, Beneath the Depths, Blood Truth, Dark in Depth, a story about Korea when Japan was annexing it, Pachinko, and the pinball game that's so interesting, and The High and Lows of Bipolar. And, of course, I think you should read all of Michael Tamman's book, especially Bad Intent, because that was really good. And I'm still waiting for Mark Zuccarelli to come on my show to talk about all this.
We will get him on, yes. We'll get him on. He's quite a character.
Yeah, the two of you together. I mean, that would be a riot. So I have a few more thoughts in my brain that are coming clear. Parents, what about communities where things happen and violence happens, and you're seeing what's happened in Palestine now that they named Jerusalem the capital of Israel? I get both sides of the coin. The problem is that is killing people and burning things the answer? And what about vigilante justice even here in America? How do we stop that? Because that's even more dangerous.
Well, you know, vigilantism always leads to problems. You know, again, we don't want people taking their own hands. You know, I don't know that I'd equate that, you know, to what's going on in the Middle East. There's so much more out there than just vigilantism. There's, you know, deep-rooted religious beliefs on that thing, deep-rooted, you know, religious, political, sociological issues there, you know, so complicated. Greater minds than mine, you know, much greater, mm-hmm. you know, I would tackle that. And, you know, I don't know that we could address that here in terms of, you know, just trying to fight crime and terrorism within that country. You know, we knew that, you know, the proclamation by the president, you know, and I'm neither making statements for or against his proclamation, but, you know, we knew that it would generate some violence somewhere. And, you know, when that supposedly was the motivation of this New York attacker, you know, I don't know if that's true or not. You know, people come up with a lot of reasons for things. We know there was violence other parts of the world. But, again, we have to do things that we can't be intimidated by those who are going to object to it with violence. But, you know, violence sometimes has worked for people. We can look back, and again, I'm not going to name names because it's just the sensitivity of it, but look back, and there have been groups and causes that have gotten concessions by violence. So, you know, sometimes it does work, unfortunately. And we try to quash it, and you sometimes can't quash an idea, but violence is sometimes seeded some results of people or movements, and we can't deny that. So we have to know that some people will resort to that. So we have to think carefully when we make any kind of major move politically or legally, and think what are the consequences going to be. It doesn't mean we shouldn't move forward. We're doing the right thing, but what's going to be the consequence, and how are we going to respond? So, always give those things thought. If we do A, it's going to cause B. But, you know, if we feel we're making the right decision, let's be ready for this. Let's be ready for any, you know, counteraction and be able to stand that ground. And that's what we need to do.
Well, how does the media fuel some of this? Do they make it worse? Do they sort of, you know, I watch in the morning, I get up and I watch Channel 12, Channel 7, Channel 2, Channel 4. And it could be the same story, like this, what happened yesterday. And you get different viewpoints. And sometimes I say, well, this channel's really doing a bad job. They're making fuel for fire. Do they sometimes make it worse and that people react even more?
I think the media can make it worse. I think most of the mainstream media actually does a decently fair job, in reporting information. They have made some errors recently, and while an honest error is okay, they should be always be careful to vet their information. Again, even though they're just reporting what is being said, we can't mistake the power of the media just by putting out a news story there. Even though you may put the conditions on it, so-and-so is reporting, we've gotten this information as reported by, it still comes off as fact, even if you put all those, conditional statements in there. So they need to. But I think the media does a pretty good job. There's a couple of media outlets that I think, do intentionally mislead for political reasons. They give false facts. I don't like that. I don't like when facts are twisted. I just don't like lying in general from anybody. We seem to say, politicians, they lie. I don't find that funny. I don't find that acceptable. We tend to believe people in power. That's just a natural, thing. That's why, if we want to talk about wrongful convictions, which, is one of my hot button topics, it happens because when the government makes a statement, he did it, we tend to believe it. We tend to believe authority. Mm-hmm. So I think when a government official, a politician, says something that's a lie, it's really, really damaging. And the media, too. They don't have official power, but they do have power. And they need to use that power fairly and responsibly. But for the most part, and I work mostly with local media. I've done a little bit, in the national media. Maybe there is a media bias in the sense that the media tends to be liberal. It tends to attract those type of people. So maybe there's always an undertone. But I think our media has done a good job of presenting information generally fairly. But we talk about what should be reported, like when there's a shooting. I posted many, many years ago, and I think you once reposted it, Fran, one of my blogs that I talked about years ago, not giving out the name of the shooter and not lionizing them, as we tend to do when we speak about that, and we tell their story because that's what they want. They want to be lionized. They want that story out there. But the fact of the matter is we as a society have a craving for that. We want to know who did it and why. What was the motivation? What can we learn from it? How can we use it as red flags? Or sometimes we just need to understand why it happened. What made this person do that? Can I reconcile that in my mind, which we never do anyway. There's no reconciling, those kind of killings of innocent people. But as much as we tell the media not to, we're kind of saying yes and no at the same time. The fact is we want to know that information, and we press the media for it. And,
The first question they ask is that, is who did it? The first question is who did it and where it happened.
Yeah. And was he ISIS? Was he a lone wolf? What was going on? How did he get the gun? Those kind of questions. So we want all these facts.
I know. Why do they assume all the time that it's ISIS? I mean, this guy is ISIS radicalized, but he's not ISIS.
He's self-radicalized.
Scary.
There's some premise to it. We know that ISIS has reached out, on social media, on a very, just reached everybody, saying, do what you can, run people down, stab people, do whatever you can. If you can't get bombed, do whatever you can. So that message gets out there. And again, the 99.9% of those who see it, if you even pay attention to it, just dismiss it. But that's a small percentage, again, on the edge, out there on the precipice of maybe some mental illness or some weakness. And when I say mental illness, I'm not talking about, that I could diagnose it. I don't have the qualifications for that. And I'm not sure it's even something that would be diagnosed. But just in my layman opinion is that someone who could be convinced to do something like this has to have some mental weakness or illness there. We're just not designed to kill innocent people, by nature. So to have that kind of coldness in you, I think there must be something, amiss. So that's just my layman terms for it. But, again, there's just that one, that small point, whatever percentage of people who will glom onto that, say, okay, that's the message I've been waiting for. I've been waiting to hear that, and now I'm going to, take action and do something. So, again, we talk about, cults and how they attract people. Think back years, like people like Charles Manson stood on corners. And, maybe a few hundred people hear him during the day, maybe one person would sign on. So that's one more person going on another street corner. and they'll talk all day, and then maybe one other more persona, so like, you know, sort of like a pyramid scheme. But now you don't need to do that. We could reach millions of people with the push of a button, and that's how these movements can grow so quickly.
The scary part is, which is better? We have about five more minutes. Like yesterday, the guy, he got hurt, so what? And he's going to be in the hospital. And is it better when the killer, of course, is alive so they can question him? Or is it better when they dig into their family after they're dead? That's a hard decision that anybody has to make that's going after these people.
Well, we don't really get to make that decision. What happens, happens.
Yeah.
So, you know, if he had killed people, and I'm not minimizing, you know, any injuries. I'm not minimizing that at all. But if he had killed people and there were serious injuries, those victims and those families are certainly going to wish he died in the process, and justifiably so. And, you know, I don't pass judgment on that. But from a law enforcement perspective, obviously, if we could interrogate somebody and interview someone and get more information, it's that much more valuable. Because, you know, dead men do tell tales. Yeah, as I say, you know, when someone dies in these bombs, they go, where are you going to go with it? A lot of information could start. As long as you have a starting point, you have a person. It's a tremendous, you know, how that you pull that thread, all the information law enforcement could develop after someone's dead. But it's a whole lot easier when you have someone cooperating. But then again, we talk about the fact, you know, if you kill people now, you know, the time of if he goes to court, making families live through it again, you know, making them always on edge of the risk that he may not be convicted. And then, you know, society's obligation to keep him alive and somewhat, you know, safe, healthy environment somewhat, you know, all the cost in that. And we always feel, well, should that be our obligation, you know, after he's killed people? So there really is no right answer. It's how you feel. And like I said, it depends on where you are, you know, in the equation, how you feel. And how you feel is how you feel. There's no right or wrong in how you feel.
Okay, so before we go, tell everybody about your show. And I almost emailed you. Like, you did one. Did you do the one on sexual harassment in that already? Did you do that one?
We are doing that note this Thursday, on this Thursday night, 8 p.m. Central. If you go to my Facebook page, Michael Tabman, T-A-B-M-A-N, I've got a public profile. You'll see the links to the show, Crimes and Times. You can search that, too. It's on Facebook, YouTube, Twitch, Periscope, live stream. We've had some great shows. The audience grows every show we've had. There's questions keep coming in via Twitter. We've had much more success than we expected in such a short time. And we've had some great guests, really high-profile people. This week we're going to have on a discussion about sexual predators. That will be, you know, the violent criminals, you know, to what we see right now in the news, those who abuse their power. We'll have someone talk about the predator, and we'll have someone speak on behalf of the victims as well. So it should be a tremendous conversation. Everyone, please tune in, and you can tweet us, you know, at Crimes and Times, ask your questions, and we'll ask our guests and get some expert answers.
I'm going to watch that one because, to be very honest, I have never said this on the air. I was a victim of one of those things in college. And true story.
Yeah.
You know what? I wanted to be naive, but I wasn't dumb enough to fall for it. And I was smart enough to say something and speak out. That helps to have a speak out voice. And my mom introduced me to someone from our temple, believe it or not. And the person turned out to be exactly that. And I reported it both times, and unfortunately, they believed me, but they didn't do anything about it. And it was a horrible experience. I went on a date, then came home, and went into the bathroom just to freshen up, whatever. When they came out, the guy was all exposed, and he literally jumped on me, and he was huge. And it's a good thing I have a sharp right punch and a good left knee. And he was singing soprano. And I didn't even hesitate.
Yep.
And then I took his stuff and I threw it in the hall and I said, now you can leave. I don't care how you look. And I reported it to the rabbi of my temple, who said he realized that. And he said, you know, why did you go out with him? I said, because you introduced me to him. And I could not believe that, you know, the cantor of a temple would be like that. And you know what happens afterwards? Of course, he didn't get away with doing anything, and I wouldn't even go to the temple after that because I didn't want to see him. But when somebody comes over to hug you, you want to smack them in the head. And it's like, yeah, it's a horrible feeling. So I can imagine what these people that have gone through even worse. That's a good show, and that's a good topic. And I think young girls need to understand that.
And I really worked hard. I didn't want to go on with just talking about the predator himself. I wanted to hear, you know, someone. So having someone from a you know, sexual abuse prevention community type of environment will come and speak for the victims, because we have to hear their point of view and what this does to them, just like you did now.
Exactly, because sometimes they actually say, you asked for it, or it's your fault, or he would never do something like that. And unfortunately, my cell phone was in my pocketbook, otherwise it would have filmed him as he walked out. But my mom believed me, and my aunt believed me. Unfortunately, my father was gone, otherwise he probably would have explained to him why it wasn't going to happen to anybody else again. And I said to him, you're a man of the cloth, you're a cantor. How many other people have you done this to? And he couldn't answer me because I'm she, like, a lot. And then the rabbi of the temple, they never, ever, ever got rid of him, ever. I think I went back with my mom when my mom was really sick once. And he was at a luncheon. And I said to my mother, I can't sit here. I can't be in the same room with him, because he kept coming over to where I was sitting. So I said to the aide, I said, either, you know, you take my mom home by yourself after the luncheon. Well, I'm not. And then he went to sing something, and my mother started to cry. I said, this is the first time, Mom. I'm so glad you cried in public. It's okay. It's horrible.
Well, and the prevalence of it that I'm hearing now, look, you know, I was a young single male, dated. I know all this stuff about, you know, men being aggressive. It still shocked me that this level of behavior was out there. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
And sometimes I think to myself, after all my years, how could I still be so naive not to think this is going on? So I find that shocking. That's why I wanted to get right on this topic right away.
I agree with you. So tell everybody about your books. And when are you writing another one?
You know, I have one in the works, but as I, you know, you said, I'm, you know, I have these two other businesses. And the show, as you know, the shows take a lot of time preparing. I didn't realize how much time it took preparing, getting guests.
Yeah.
So between the businesses I run, you know, my two own businesses and the show, I don't find myself with a lot of free time. You know, when I wrote those books, my first two books, I wrote right when I retired, and I was home with, you know, two feet having been operated on. I had surgical boots and crutches, so I had nowhere to go, nothing to do. And then my third book, yeah, came right after Midnight Sin, you know, got some great exposure, very much in part thanks to you for your reviews. And you and I did not know each other at the time, just for the record, you know. And
That's right.
So, and then another publisher called and asked me to write another book. So that's why I wrote Bad Intent. And, you know, after that, then I started, you know, my business started getting expanding and getting busier. And I started working with the media. So I just got involved in so many different directions that I haven't really just had the time. But I would like to write another book. I have something in mind. And I started on one, and I was about 70% through. But you know what, Fran? I just didn't like it. I just said, if I'm going to write a fourth book, this one needs to be, you know, maybe not a bestseller, but it needs to be close to it. You know, I want to really bring up the level of my writing. You know.
And you have to have me read it. But you know what? You could probably take some of your shows and some of the topics and put them into a book. And that
yeah, actually,
really
the next thing I'm thinking about is based on partial reality and some of the things I've talked about and some of the things I've sort of embraced in my retirement as a, you know, my causes. So, yeah, I kind of am doing it.
So thank you so very much. And I hope you have a very good rest of the day, because I know where I'm going and it's not going to be fun. But I'm going to be brave and get it done like I always do. What can I say? And now that they got rid of the bat, we're in good shape. For those of you out there that ever come in contact seriously with a bat in your apartment, understand that even if it doesn't bite you, you have to go to the emergency room and get rabies shots and be brave, just like I was. And to be very honest, all 10 shots were not a big deal. It really was nothing. The rabies shot stings, but no big deal. Nothing that a brave person can't handle. So thank you so much. And we're going to do this again as soon as we have another topic to talk about. Thank you so much,
Fran. Always a pleasure to be on your show. Thank you.
And I can't wait to have you and Mark Zuccarelli on my show.
We will do that. Absolutely. That'll be fun.
Thank you so much. Everybody have a great day, and bye.